Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Craig Pittman, writer and award-winning journalist at the Tampa Bay Times. And we're talking about his latest book, Cat Tale, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. Craig, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
This really, you know, there are certain books that, you know, you read the title, this really does live up to the title, the weird, wild story. I don't know if I've ever come across a story of people attempting to sort of, you know, bring an animal back from the very brink of extinction, rife with so much complexity and screw-ups.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
How long have you been, the book covers decades. Actually, it goes way back to DeSoto. But, I mean, How long have you been on this story?
Oh, well, I mean, I've been writing stories about Florida Panthers for about 20 years. And every time I would do one, I would think, this would make a great book. I mean, there's these wild, strange characters. There are these twists in the plot you don't see coming. But it didn't have an ending. You need an ending before you start writing a book. And then finally, about 3 years ago, I got a good ending. And I said, okay, now I can write this.
Now, I'm just going to tell people that you need to read the book. We're not going to give away the ending. But please read the book, because what we're going to talk about is a lot of screwed up stuff.
Yes.
Please read the book. Let's talk about the Florida panther. It's a subspecies of the North American mountain lion?
Yes, the puma. Yeah, it's, you know, the pumas you find out west, you know, in the desert or in the mountains or prowling around the Hollywood sign in Beverly Hills. Same species as the Florida panther, but the Florida panther is a subspecies. It's according to the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission here in Florida, it's genetically distinct from them.
Now, when the Europeans first landed, and what's great is I love reading names like from my childhood, Ponce de Leon and De Soto. Thank you for putting that in the book. Finally, I've got to use that information. When they landed, how common were the panthers?
Well, I mean, back then panthers ranged all over the South. I mean, they're range went all the way up towards Tennessee and over in the west towards Texas. But as humans encroached on their turf and, you know, chopped down forests and killed the deer, the panthers slowly got backed into a corner down in the southern tip of the Florida Peninsula, south of the Caloosahatchee River.
It seems like even by the late 1800s, they were in trouble as a species.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely, definitely.
But there's so many...
I love the fact that the word went out to the hunters, hey, panthers are dying out. Hurry up and go get yours.
Yeah, yeah. That's happened with a number of other species too, including the great auk. Now, but there's so many odd things that there's some obvious things that contribute to their decline. Like, and we'll talk more about this about development in Florida. But things like the deer massacre in 1939. Talk about that.
Well, so there was a tick-borne disease that was spreading among Florida's cattle, and Florida's cattlemen back then were very, very politically powerful, so whatever they wanted to do about it, that's what the state did, and so they organized these mass hunts to go out in the woods and kill off, you know, thousands of white-tailed deer. Well, that's the main food for panthers, and so the panthers, you know, when they couldn't find deer to eat, they would go attack the cattle, so then the cattlemen started shooting the panthers, too.
And then just all these events like that all along the way. And then finally, let's talk about, we're going to skip around, and I just want to mention that for the benefit of the audience. Big Cypress, one of the last resorts of the panther. There was an Everglades Jetport project. Talk to me about that. When was that?
That was in the late 60s. And the idea then was that the Miami airport was getting overcrowded. And so the folks in charge of that, which was the Dade County Port Authority, decided, well, the answer to this is to build a bigger airport, and the perfect place to build it is out in the middle of nowhere, out in this big swamp, where there are no neighbors to object. And so they planned to build what would be ultimately the largest airport in the world out there, and they called it the Everglades Jetport. And in addition to this gigantic airport they were going to plop down in the middle of this big swampy area, They were planning to have all kinds of roads. They're going to have a high-speed boat canal, and it would generate lots and lots of development all around it. Basically, it would put the whole thing under pavement is what it would have done. And this weird coalition of hunters and bird watchers and Native American tribes and people who were just fans of Everglades National Park in general all banded together to try and stop this thing, and they managed to persuade Florida's first Republican governor in the 20th century, Claude Kirk, to shut down state support for it, and that led to, ultimately, to Richard Nixon cutting off federal funding for it. It's one of the very first, if not the first, triumphs of the environmental movement in Florida, and people still look back at that. There's still they built a little tiny training airport out there, and that's still there. And so whenever somebody discovers it, they're like, "Hey, what's that doing out there?" Well, here's the story, you know. And this was the event that galvanized Marjorie Stoneman Douglas to become an activist. She was in her 70s then. She had written the book Everglades River of Grass back in the 40s to call attention to Everglades National Park. And so when this thing came up that was a threat to it, and everybody, you know, from John D. McDonald on was writing stories about it, one of the activists who was trying to stop the jet port went to her and said, "Hey, you know, if you came out against this thing, it would mean a lot." And she said, "Nobody's going to listen to a half-blind old lady. People listen to organizations." And the guy said, "Well, then why don't we start an organization?" So the guy's name is Joe Browder. Joe Browder and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas started Friends of the Everglades with dues of $1 a year, and they came out very strongly against the Everglades jet port and helped to get it stopped.
But what did people think about the panther then at that point in time? Did they think it still existed?
There was one of the interesting things about the jet port was that one of the things that stopped it was the very first environmental impact statement that was ever prepared. It was drawn up by Aldo Leopold's son, Luna, and his support staff. And they estimated, and this was like a total wild guess, that there were 100 panthers left and that most of them lived in Big Cypress.
Where'd they get that number?
They pulled it out of their butts, basically. I mean, I don't know if I can say this, but there's a phrase among biologists that I've heard several times, scientific wild-ass guess. It's a swag.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so I think this is totally a swag. But then in 1973, when the Endangered Species Act passed, panthers were on the very first endangered list, and a lot of supposedly smart Florida state officials said, "Why have you got that on the list? They're gone. Nobody's seen them in years. We think they're already extinct. Why bother to even list them?" And so the World Wildlife Fund wasn't convinced, and so they hired a legendary Texas tracker named Roy McBride.
And his hounds
to come to Florida and find out if there were any panthers left. And Roy, you know, turned the dogs loose and tracked around, and he found one scrawny female panther and then signs that he estimated about 20 more total. And so, you know, obviously they weren't gone, but there weren't that many left either.
Is this all in the Big Cypress area?
Yeah, it was all in that same general region there south of the Caloosahatchee River. And, you know, in the vicinity of Lake Okeechobee, if people are familiar with that, with that picture of the state that has the big hole down towards the bottom, that's Lake Okeechobee.
So
that led to the state saying, "Well, gee, I guess we better do something to protect them." And they, you know, started the effort to figure out, A, where are panthers, and B, you know, what do they need?
Let's talk about the habitat. What's the habitat like there?
Well, the area they had kind of been crowded into or hemmed into was sort of the last area that was not seeing any development at all at that time, because it was just so swampy. You know, Big Cypress, which ultimately became a national preserve, by the way, after the jet port stopped. Corkscrew Swamp area, the Fakahatchee Strand State Preserve. People may be familiar with Fakahatchee Strand because it's the location where the ghost orchid, made famous by Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. That's where that was located and where the action took place. So and I think she described it as a green hell. I wouldn't go that far, but it's not an easy place to get through, much less get to. And so that sort of protected them and enabled them to continue to live there. And there were still plenty of deer for them to eat. And the feral hogs that had been turned loose way back by when Hernando de Soto came here thinking he was going to find gold. And instead he left us the gift of invasive pigs.
There starts to assemble a sort of group of conservationists, and people are concerned about it. Most of them at first have never worked with panthers, don't know anything about mountain lions. There's people like Chris Belden, Melody, is it Relke?
Relke.
And the people are meaning well, But there's just a lot of, like, not knowing what they're doing.
Yeah, they're doing. They were ignorant. I mean, and Chris Bell is a very meticulous, very patient, very thoughtful guy, was put in charge of the Panther program, had never seen a Panther before in his life, hadn't studied Panthers, didn't know anything about them, but he set about in a very, you know, meticulous, painstaking way to learn about them, and it sort of paid a great dividend. He made a public appeal said, please tell me where you've seen Panthers. And he would go out and give speeches about this. He'd write stories about it to run in magazines and so forth. And every time one of these stories would appear, there'd be a picture of a Panther next to it. And these people would see these, you know, the sleek, beautiful, magnificent predator prowling through the underbrush. And they go, wow, that's a beautiful animal. And so in 1981, when the head of the Department of Education here thought it would be a great idea for Florida school kids to vote on what would be the state animal, they picked the panther. Much to everyone's surprise, everybody assumed they were going to pick the alligator or something like that. No, they voted to make the panther the state animal. And in 1982, when the legislature was supposed to ratify this, some of them were saying, it's not the panther, it's the gator. Everybody knows it's the gator. And they were bombarded with angry letters from the school children saying, why are you trying to overturn our election? So they voted to make the panther the state animal, which raised its profile, meant that it got a lot more funding for research, and basically meant that the panther would get a lot more attention than it would have gotten otherwise. I mean, so I honestly think you could argue that the Florida school children actually saved the panther.
You're listening to... It
had not been the state animal. You know?
Nobody would pay attention.
Right.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Craig Pittman, writer, award-winning journalist at the Tampa Bay Times. And we're talking about his latest book. It's an amazing read. Cat Tail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. They basically find out that they were in three sort of separate areas in southern Florida. Big Cypress.
But close to each other.
Big Cypress, yeah. Everglades National Park, and the FAC. And they decide that maybe it would be a good idea to collar them. How did that go?
Yes. Well, that was Belden's idea. It's something that had been tried in the 60s out west with some success. And so he decided, well, that's the way to figure out where they are and where they go. And so and of all the reports he'd gotten from all over the state, the only verified sightings he was able to document were the ones in that area. So once again, he hired Roy McBride. Roy's like my Zelig. You know, he shows up whenever there's some important action going on. Roy's there, and they go out with the dogs and track down these panthers and put radio collars on them. And initially, Chris would then go out with a big drive around in his pickup truck with an H-shaped antenna and stop about every mile and stand up on the truck bed and raise the antenna and see if he picked up anything. And most times he didn't. And so finally, he figured out, you know, I need an airplane for this because these are very wide ranging animals that, as they soon learned, would go, you know, 20, 30 miles a night. So they started flying airplanes, small planes over the area, and picking up, you know, the radio signals to figure out where they went.
But even this process, Craig, didn't go smoothly. I mean, there's the story of FP3.
Yes, FP3 is the story that starts the book. It starts off with their pursuit of FP3. They whenever they capture a panther and put a collar on it, they give it a number, like, you know, Florida Panther 1, 2, 3. Well, this was number 3. Well, the batteries in its collar were going bad, so they needed to recapture it and replace the batteries. And they, you know, the dog, Roy and his dogs, chased it down, ran it up a tree, and shot it with a tranquilizer dart. But the dart hit the femoral artery, and the panther fell from the tree and died. In spite of the efforts of not one, but two biologist to give it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which...
That's amazing.
Honestly, yeah, that's a devotion to the job you seldom see in America these days.
God.
And so, you know, it dies, and Belden carries it out of the swamp on his shoulders, feeling like he's just basically killed off every panther that's left, you know, and it kind of shattered his life, but ultimately it led to good things because the people in charge of the state, what was in the state game commission, said, you know, maybe we should start sending a veterinarian out there with these panthers with these panther captures instead of having it just be biologists. And so they picked the perfect person for it, Melody Relke, who had some experience dealing with cheetahs up in the Pacific Northwest at a sanctuary there, and came in. She knew that they had suffered from genetic defects from inbreeding, and she actually came in to work on the Panther Project looking for the same thing here and very quickly found it.
And this brings up the next thing I want to talk about. They're starting to get to know the Florida panther closely.
Yes.
And there are some characteristics. It has a weird kink in the tail. There's a cowlick. Yes. There's flex around the neck. But then the more they get to know about it, it's got things like low sperm quality, low body weights. They're anemic. In a lot of the males, the testicles don't descend correctly.
Yeah. I mean, they were bad off. They were really bad off. And the thing is, because they knew so little about the panthers to start with, initially they thought that kink in the tail was just a normal characteristic of panthers. And when Melody Relke got started, she said, no, that's a genetic defect. That's about the biggest red flag you could ask for.
Oh, my God.
That the tail would take a 90-degree bend like you'd find in a math textbook. And when she spotted that, she started looking for others, and, you know, she found the low sperm count. She found the problem with the testicles. Some of the cats had holes in their heart, what they call atrial septal defects. And she started, raising all kinds of alarms. And because she's a woman and because she was not a biologist, initially people weren't listening to her. They were not paying attention. They kept saying, no, habitat's the big problem. This genetic defect thing you're telling us about, we're not buying it. But finally she got their attention, they realized, okay, panthers are actually worse off than we even thought.
Yeah. Now, they found out that the cats in the Everglades were eating better than those in the Big Cypress and the FAC. Why?
Well, they were eating better, number one, because there was no hunting there. But the other thing that was meant, the other reason that their health was better was because they were descendants of some captive-raised panthers. Everglades National Park in the late 40s and early 50s had run out of panthers. And so they put in a call to one of these classic Florida roadside attractions, a place called Everglades Wonder Gardens, and said, which was run by a couple of ex-bootleggers from Detroit, Lester and Bill Piper. And they said, hey, can we, Everglades Wonder Gardens, this is the real Everglades calling. Can we have some of your panthers? And they said, yeah, we got plenty. These two ex-bootleggers go over to Everglades National Park and turn loose some panthers. They did it twice. And apparently one of them had... was not a purebred panther. It had some South American puma genes in it. And as a result, it refreshed their genetic pool so that the panthers in Everglades National Park did not have the kink in the tail. And so when the Florida capture team went over there for the first time to start capturing Everglades National Park panthers, and they saw that those panthers did not have a kink, suddenly the things Melody Relke had been saying made sense. And they were like, oh, I guess you're right. Before we go, I have to mention, I love Everglades Wonder Gardens. I've been there.
Yeah.
It's quite an amazing place, and I love the story.
I've actually been there.
You've been, okay, so you've seen all the alligators. Yep, that's what they're famous for, is the alligators, but they also had a bear for a long time, and the bear actually appears in the movie version of the Yearling.
That's right.
With Gregory Peck and Jane Wyman, and when they first brought the bear out there for the big scene where the dogs attacked the bear, and they turned the bear loose, and all the dogs ran away. And the author of the book, Marjorie Cannon Rawlings, was there, and she said, well, the problem is you got city dogs. I'll bring you some country dogs tomorrow. So she rounded up some dogs that were owned by her neighbors in Cross Creek and brought them out to where they were shooting the next day, and they turned those dogs loose, and the bear ran away. they had to finally look for it for 3 days before they found it.
By the way, for those of you listening, now you get a sense of what this book is about. It's a long and woolly story. Now, there's a character I got to mention, incredibly important, David Mayer.
Yes.
What a fascinating,
very controversial figure.
Oh, my God. If you're ever going to make a movie out of this book, he'd be the star role that would be the most interesting person to play, because what a weird character.
Well, and I've gotten some flack from his friends and fans. He still has plenty of fans about the portrayal in the book, but I feel like I bent over backwards to be fair to him and to show people.
You did. First of all, I want to mention that I think this is a great piece of journalism, so that I take this as you reporting. It's a great book to read, and I couldn't put it down. But it is journalism, and you take that very seriously in this book. So people are given a fair shake.
Yeah.
Still.
I mean, I couldn't interview him because he died in a plane crash in 2008, but I got his personnel records from the state. I read his book that he wrote about Panthers. I read through every interview he did and wound up being able to get some quotes from an unpublished interview he did with a graduate student who was working on a thesis, and tried to put together a portrait of him that was fair to him, because he did some good things for Panthers.
Sure.
But it gets all to the other side.
Right. And what an amazing story it is. All I can say is, as a reader, here's how I came out of this. He really portrays himself and thinks of himself as God's gift to Panthers. I mean, he was Mr. Panther.
I think his coworkers would say you're right about that.
But in the end, he ends up being part of the problems with the development schemes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one of the most amazing switches. I mean, I could deal with his egotism. That's cool. But that sort of switching sides kind of thing, what did you make out of that?
I tried to kind of peer into his mind based on his writings and so forth. And I think he had developed this idea of himself that nothing could shake, and that anything he did was a good thing, and that he was never wrong. And so when you have that mindset of with zero self-doubt whatsoever, then you're liable to blunder into some bad decisions. And, the other thing, too, is some of the quotes he gave to the college, his college interviewer, sounded like he felt like he'd been treated so badly when he worked for the state that maybe this was a way for him to make up for that. The money that was coming in would make up for all the years when he felt like he was underpaid and underappreciated.
But he committed the basic sin of science, and he faked data.
Yeah, well, when you toss out 40% of the data because it doesn't fit your theory, that's kind of a red flag. What you're doing is not right. But he had reasons that he cited to his co-author about why he was doing it that way, and his co-author's like, well, he knows Panthers better than I do, so they went ahead and produced this paper that developers then used to, build all over the place in Panther habitat.
Tracking his story throughout your book is one of the amazing stories. And we're going to run out of time. I just want to mention, so they decided that they're going to do a captive breeding program.
Yes.
That doesn't work out really well either.
No. Well, I mean, that's sort of the standard thing you do when you're sort of at the end of trying to help an endangered species come back, is you capture some of them and you put them in a captive breeding program. And it doesn't work because there are all kinds of unexpected hardships. In the case of the Panthers, it didn't work because the kittens they captured had the same genetic defects, so they couldn't breed either. But initially, they were talking about capturing every single panther that was in the wild, which that's crazy. and an animal welfare activist from Gainesville ended up suing the state and saying, stop, you don't know what you're doing, you're panicked, you don't have a plan, you need a plan. And you're going to do more harm than good unless you figure out what you're going to do.
But it doesn't end there, Craig, because the survivors were rounded up and sold to a place that did canned hunts.
That's a different story. That's a different story.
That was when they were
working on the idea of starting a new colony of panthers up in North Florida.
But those were
Some of those wound up being sold to places that did canned hunts, and the state had to buy them back when word got out.
Reading this book is like a roller coaster, because just when you think it's okay, this could possibly work, and everything just falls apart. And then some other weird piece of news comes out, like just out of nowhere, they find that some of the panthers have elevated levels of mercury. So you're thinking, like, how is that happening? How's that happening?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's still a problem. The people who the state has hired to go out and hunt pythons have been warned, don't eat the pythons. They have mercury in them.
Huh.
So, it would be great if they could capture the pythons and then sell the meat, but they can't.
Oh, my God. Well, finally, there's a Hail Mary plan. I don't want to give it away, okay?
No.
There's a Hail Mary plan that actually sort of works, and it's great.
And it's an unprecedented thing.
That's right.
Nobody knew if it would work. And, I have to say that the chapter titled Hail Mary is, in a way, my favorite chapter of the book, because although it's at that point, they were really at the low point and despairing of being able to save the Panthers. But it's also, to me, the funniest chapter, because you hear Roy McBride's story of how he did this thing that it's just, I'm just going to say one thing. It involves a blindfolded mule, and that's all I'm going to say about it. And it's hysterically funny, and he's never told that story before.
But even today, I mean, there's still this weird thing that goes on with permitting of development in their property. And there's some incredible stories. We're almost out of time because I was going to have you tell the story of Tom Mahagan and the Ava Maria Project, which is sort of an example of the kind of insanity that goes on in South Florida.
Yeah.
But how are these things getting permitted? I mean, it's amazing. It seems like people in Fish and Wildlife are just sort of green lighting any project.
They are. And they feel like they're doing what Congress wants them to do, and nobody in Congress has objected to it. And that's their source of funding. So, you know, who's to say they're wrong? There have been a number of lawsuits that have overturned their decisions for being arbitrary and capricious. One in particular from a federal judge on a mining project that was going to be in panther habitat, where the judge said, you're looking at each individual permitting decision separately from the others, and you should be looking at them as an aggregate, that, you know, you're not just saying yes to this project that's going to wipe out 100 acres of panther habitat, but you've already said yes to thousands more. So it's incrementally worse each time you say yes. And then I had interviewed a top Fish and Wildlife Service official who told me the exact opposite. No, you have to look at these things separately.
Oh,
you can't look at them together.
Oh, man.
So.
And what's incredible is the panthers continue to run up against humanity. Of course, people get scared and freak out. And it's the same thing that's happening here in Massachusetts with bears and bobcats and coyotes. It's the more people develop into the places that were formerly wild, these animals decide, screw you, we're going to continue about our life. And that's what's happening with panthers.
They show up. I got numerous stories of not just panthers, but bears and alligators that show up in people's houses, and people are freaking out, going, oh my God, what are they doing here? Well, they used to live here.
That's right.
Before you. And so the bear winds up swinging in somebody's backyard hammock or chilling out in the hot tub, and the gator's, thumping his tail up against the wall at 4 a.m, and people think somebody's knocking on the door, and the panther's, peering through somebody's sliding glass door, gobbling up their backyard chickens, because, hey, it's there, and they figure it's theirs,
Well, I can tell you, as people, you got to read the book, because it's got a great ending. We're completely out of time. We could talk about just one chapter of this book for hours. My guest tonight has been Craig Pittman, writer and award-winning journalist at the Tampa Bay Times, and a good example of what he does is this book, Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. An amazing story, Craig. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.